Thank you, Gordon. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today and share a little bit about some of the programming that I've been working with as part of a team in the northern part of Florida. And Gordon asked the question, Lincoln, before you came in, how many states had extension irrigation specialists? So there's ours actually living right there. One of ours. So we are fortunate in Florida to have that expertise and assistance. Before I even get started in this presentation, I want to just sort of visit with you a little bit and make sure that the credit is given to the group that sort of fostered all of this stuff that I've learned to be able to implement with the farmers through what was the American Society of Plasticulture and now has been absorbed into this group as the Plasticulture Working Group. So over the years, many years ago, when the Plasticulture Society was very active and vibrant, that was one of the meetings that I just was not going to miss. That was the main one, and was such a practical learning experience that I really felt important to do. So most of what you're going to see here is taking that information that I've learned now with the American Society of Horticulture Science, but before with the American Society for Plasticulture, and taking it back home and trying to implement it. A little bit of background on my area where I'm doing this work. I'm in the northern part of the state, maybe 3 hours north of here, just before the Georgia line. And it's typically known as the Suwannee River area. So the Suwannee River runs through that area, which makes it very environmentally sensitive, just like the Chesapeake Bay would be where Gordon is. So we have this, a lot of similar challenges to what Gordon would do in Delaware and Maryland. We have deep sandy soils, typically less than certainly 1.5%, but many cases less than 1% organic matter. And early in my career down here, I was mostly working with plasticulture adoption. In fact, when I left my extension job in Delaware and came to Florida, the first thing that they put in front of me was a dually truck with a trailer and a mulch machine, and said, go out and teach these farmers how to use plastic mulch, because at that time there was zero plastic mulch in the northern part of the state where I am, plenty in the southern part, but not up in that area. So that was the first mission, and that went really, really well. It gave me an opportunity to gain some credibility with the farmers and knowing how to operate a piece of equipment like that. But since then, it's been more important to try to help work with these farmers on the actual management of it, the nutrient and the water management. And because of the regulatory aspects that are coming down the pike, this is not really an option for the growers much anymore. This is something that they're going to have to do, even though it's still in a quasi-voluntary kind of capacity. So in Florida, the best management program is very active in certain hot spots of the state, and the Suwannee Valley area is one of those hot spots. So a farmer would sign up voluntarily and commit that they are going to adopt these best management programs. And if they do adopt them, and if they can document that they've adopted them, then they get a couple of things in the middle of this slide that are very important to them. And that is the presumption of compliance and the waiver of liability. So that if I am a neighboring property owner and think that that farmer has contaminated my well with nitrate levels or something like that, then I have a certain level of protection from the state if I've joined the BMP program and if I can document that I have adopted those best management practices, the best that science could provide. So that has been a really, really important piece of the puzzle. And as we get more and more nutrient criteria established, and now basin management action plans that are going to be implemented in the area, this is going to continue to even get ramped up. So I say that as a background, in that it's you're going to see where a lot of these early adopting growers have been ahead of the curve here, and some of our best success stories for this region that I'm going to be talking about. But nonetheless, it's a really, really big issue in the future, and I think creates an opportunity for us in our extension programs, because we have a captive audience. They not only think that they need to do or think that they want to do this, but they actually are going to realize pretty quickly, if they didn't already, that they're going to have to do some of these things. So the way that I've tried to categorize the program here is going to be looking at what we've done from an extension standpoint with the objective of improving the efficiency of water and nutrients, and specifically this is going to be for plastic mulch and drip irrigation folks in that particular region, which there probably is easily 12 or 15,000 acres of that kind of production going on in that region. This program that I'm going to be talking about does not specifically address the overhead irrigation growers, which is even a much larger group in the region. In fact, we had a recent survey within that district would estimate that there's at least 2,000 pivot irrigation systems in this particular region. So it's there's a lot of water being drawn. This is if you were in the Suwannee Valley area, you would know that you're not in Orlando. This is a very rural area with small towns that build this region, and very, very powerful agriculturally driven region. The methods on the right-hand side would be the things starting out early on with just trying to do some research work to figure out how we were going to be able to implement a lot of these programs, and probably early on focusing a lot of our work on in terms of field days at the Research and Education Center in the middle of that region, which is where I work, by the way. I'm a county extension employee, but I work out of a center, which is kind of a unique thing and has been, I believe, really important to whatever success we've had in this particular program, because I'm at a location where I can help to do a lot of these hands-on things that Gordon mentioned a little bit ago. We began, after the research parts of things, we began a series of drip irrigation schools, and we've had over a dozen of those schools, and I'll be talking a little bit more about those kinds of things, and certainly have incorporated on-farm demonstrations, working with specific growers to demonstrate to that particular grower what they can be doing, and then oftentimes utilizing those sites for on-farm field days. Interestingly enough, in the small farms piece of the puzzle, we have a lot of small farmers that we're working with, small to medium size farmers. In fact, in Florida, of the 47,000 farms in Florida, what percentage of those farms would you suspect are small farms? 60? For those that are in Florida might already know the answer. We have over 90% of the farms in Florida are categorized as small farms in that USDA definition of up to $250,000 of income. So many of us might think, well, that's a pretty big farm. That's not real. Maybe $100,000 or less income would better fit that category. And it drops down to maybe 85%. So the reality is we got a lot of small farms, and a lot of them are new to extension. They don't know anything about extension. They certainly don't know anything about designing an irrigation system or even what drip or trickle is. Had to change that language from Delaware, it was trickle irrigation. Florida had to stop saying trickle. I had to start saying drip. So, but here's the current situation that we would use as sort of a general guide for things. And that is that we're going to certainly start out with some basic principles like a soil test. And then if for us in Florida, we're looking at putting all of the phosphorus and all the micronutrients in the bed as a pre-plant application. And we're not looking at putting that in a deep groove like they used to do as a traditional practice. We're trying to keep that fertilizer up into the root zone. And then one-third of the most leachable nutrients, nitrogen and potassium, are going to be applied in the bed as a pre-plant. And that can vary for anywhere from plus or minus of that third of the material. It might be a little bit more, might be a little bit less. In fact, there's some situations where growers don't put anything in the bed if they've got high phosphorus and high micronutrients. Not saying that that's what we would suggest for everyone, but it can be done. And then the remaining nitrogen and potassium are going to be fertigated through the drip system, and we're going to try to fine-tune that with sap testing analysis or dry tissue analysis being sent off. And this is especially important in years when we have a lot of rain. Last year and this year both were falling into that category. And then we want to make sure that they know when to stop the fertigations. If they're a watermelon grower and they know they're going to stop harvesting in another 2 weeks, let's say, that they don't need to keep on fertigating all the way up until the very final harvest interval. Just a little snapshot here for those that may not be familiar with this or not used to working with these kind of soils. This is a picture of the challenge that we have. These are deep sands, relatively unrestricted down, maybe as deep as 10 or 12 feet. So we don't have a perched anything. We don't have a hard. We don't have much of anything to help us. So we really have to be good managers on these deep sandy soils in that region. So for those that might be familiar with the seepage irrigation that is very commonplace in certain parts of Florida, the Suwannee Valley area is not that. This is much more typical of other areas. There is no seepage irrigation in the Suwannee Valley region. So one of the first things that we were working with in going out onto farms is trying to help these growers, and this goes back maybe many years, 15 years ago or so, where the only options at that time were tensiometers and the granular matrix sensors. And I would certainly agree with Gordon that for a small grower, the only thing that they can really maybe afford to do is a tensiometer, and it's still tried and proven device. It becomes a pain in the butt for a lot of times people that need to keep track of them and keep them serviced and things like that. And so over time we have sort of changed a little bit for most of these larger growers that can afford a little more sophisticated devices. But certainly we started out with tensiometers, and then we went to the granular matrix sensors. And for our sandy soils, the common sensor that's used is not very effective in our deep sands. There was a period in time when there was a sensor that they had that we started working with and loved it. And we were ready to implement it next year, got a grant, got all these sensors, and they sent the next batch in. Well, they had stopped using the one or terminated the manufacturing of the one that was good for the Florida soils. And so I was left in a little bit of a bind there and begged them to try to continue to make a more sensitive one and identify it for sandy soils, just like they do with the tensiometers, but that was not done. So the granular matrix sensors in our area have not been nearly as dependable. And more and more we've gone to the portable TDR probes like you see in the lower right-hand side. And I would say that this is, for the most part, the grower preference using these portable TDR probes. In Florida, to help our extension programs, just this past year, there was some money that came from the Department of Agriculture and the Office of Ag Water Policy to put in some mini grants for extension agents to help implement these kinds of practices on the on farms. And I was able to get some funding put together for about $15,000 to equip all of the county agents in the region where I'm working to be able to have a TDR, and then you're going to see a little bit later the petiole sap testing devices. So it's really hard to keep up with the farmers if we as county agents don't have the tools that they're able to get in cost sharing. So that was a really important piece that we just did implement. There were a few agents that had those tools and devices, but not everyone. And now I'm happy to say that all seven key counties in that region have these devices and can begin to utilize them. If you're not familiar with these, the Spectrum Technology booth has a lot of this. This is one of the locations, one of the companies that has sold a lot of that kind of product in our area. So the larger the farms get, or even a small farm, if they can get into some automation where they can go from zone to zone with automatic switching valves, and I know you'll hear more about this a little bit later, so I won't go into a whole lot of detail about that. But we're using these handheld TDR probes, and for our deep sands, we're trying to keep that soil moisture between 8 and 12%. And we want the grower to make a consistent reading time, not vary in the morning, in the afternoon, just after irrigation. We want them to be able to set a time. And as an example here, this would be a situation of daily readings taken in the middle of the day, just before the irrigation zone comes on, so that they know what the driest level of that particular zone is going to be. And then the specifics of where we're going to do the sensor reading for us is going to be something like 4 inches from the drip tape, but in the middle of the bed down the row. Because if you have a row of tomatoes next to the drip tape, typically it's going to be about 4 inches off to the drip, and you can take it in between those plants going down the row. But having some consistent level of doing that is really important. You saw some of these pictures earlier in Gordon's presentation. I just want to mention, when we began to realize that we could really do a good job of some of the hands-on part of this training, we had the Research and Education Center where we could implement a lot of these hands-on trainings, and we started the drip school, drip irrigation school. And the location where I am in Live Oak, we've had at least a dozen of those, but there have also been locations around the state where something very similar to this have been implemented at other locations throughout the state. But I would say Live Oak is the one that has the most consistent history of this. And what we typically are going to do is almost a summary of what Gordon's presentation was, where we're going to start out with some classroom activities that are going to work with some of the design considerations, and then we're going to be able to go ahead and show them the different components of the system, filters, valves, all that kind of thing. Also to make sure that they understand the backflow regulations in Florida. You not only have to have a check valve for backflow prevention, but you also have to have a low pressure drain that's going to allow that material not just get stopped, but it's actually going to have to drain back under low pressure if any of that escapes past the check valve. And we also were able to show them all the different kinds of soil moisture sensors as well. I've shown you those in those earlier slides. And then we spend a lot of time out in the field, and so we can set up a number of different things. The favorite for us has definitely been this blue dye, and you see a little bit of the idea here of the picture on the lower right is a system where we had each of those rows with a different type of drip tape, and so we can show the growers after we've done this digging. Now, this is obviously a lot of work to do this and to go out and dig and make sure all this is going to work out. It's a lot of work, but it has been one of those things that has been the undeniable truth, so to speak. Like I think my brother George in the back there, when we were growing up on the farm, I'm not sure we could have convinced our dad and uncles that water is going to move that much. There's just no way that we could have convinced him just in a debate, and we would not have won that debate, by the way. But with the blue dye, I think I would have had a chance. So this has really been an excellent teaching tool for us. We can show them what the difference in the emitter spacing makes, the difference in the flow rate of the tapes, the difference in different levels of time that you're going to run the system, and it's just been an incredibly valuable teaching tool. So we spend a lot of time on this particular component because they remember that piece of the puzzle. We also have offered this to go out onto farms and do it on their farm. Even though these soils are going to be similar to what we might have at the research center, it might not be exactly the same as what they would have on their farm. So we offer that up as well to go out onto their farm and show them the blue dye demonstration. The other piece that hasn't been mentioned directly here yet, but I think this whole deal about drip irrigation and the drip irrigation schools, we can talk to them a little bit about food safety. Because this is a big, huge issue about the way that they're going to, what the water source is, how they're going to be using it. Can they do a little better job, maybe easier to get through a food safety audit if they're using drip irrigation? All of the various things that lead them to the advantage of being able to use drip on these fresh fruit and vegetable farms is very, very important and becoming even more important as time goes on. So we are able to address that as well. When we do the blue dye, we typically will use two different cuts across the bed. I don't know if you can see it very well, but maybe in the upper right-hand corner there, and that one you can sort of see where the drip irrigation tube was lying just under the plastic mulch. So in this case, we're cutting it across section so they can see how deep the blue dye goes. And what we do in setting this thing up is we inject a pulse of food grade blue dye. It's the marker dye that's used in the sprayer tanks, same material, $50 or so a gallon, and we use it pretty heavy because we want to have a nice blue ring when we do this. And so we can irrigate after we've made that initial pulse with just plain water for 1 hour in the upper left, and then 2 hours, 4 hours, and 8 hours, and we can push it down. And you can see in the lower right-hand side, for somebody that turns it on and thinks, well, I'm just going to run it all day long, we can show them what that means. And they're going to get down into that deeper sand where they're never going to be able to get that nutrient back. And a lot of leaching losses, a lot of problems if they're going to overdo it. So this has been the way that we do the cross-section. This is coming down the side of the bed. where we can show how long it might take for the individual emitters to meet up by using the blue dye as the demonstrating marker material there. In fact, with soils that are similar over the years, Eric Simone, the vegetable specialist at the time, was doing a lot of the research work with this, and actually was able to come up with a formula to predict if we know what the volume of the drip irrigation tape is. We can almost predict how deep it's going to go in those types of sands, and it was pretty consistent over time, enough to come up with a regression line. For those of you that know what that means, it might mean something to you more than it does to me, but I think it's about 7 inches or so. once this popularity got out, it was obvious it was something that we could really make some headway with. We had this little trailer, loaded up the pieces and parts, and started doing these demonstrations out on farms. For those of you that have been working with farmers might know that sometimes it's kind of tough for them to take a break and spend some time with you when you're going out onto their farm. But in the case of the blue dye, this is one of those demonstration things where they always had time for us because they wanted to see what had gone on. And the way that we would do this, the generator and the pumping system, we've simplified that significantly from what this slide shows. We just use a little transfer pump from Tractor Supply for $50 or $60 and take a little battery with us, and we can make our own little manifold, pump it in for a couple of 50-foot sections of tape. Really easy to do. Unhook it, go home, and say, I'll be back in 5 days, a week, or whatever it is, and we'll come back and dig, depending on how much irrigation they're doing at the time. Might be sooner than that if they're irrigating a lot. But when we start digging, we don't have to ask them questions about what happened. The blue dye is going to tell them it will tell on them if they haven't been managing it the proper way. So early on, I will definitely say that we were digging some really deep holes to find blue dye. 5 foot, 6 foot, 7 foot deep holes when they were really doing a poor job of irrigation management. Now you rarely are going to find those kind of situations. The growers have really adopted it, and I believe due to this kind of an opportunity. In the lower left, you see the much more simplified system, one of our county agents in that region, Chris Van, with the little pumping system that we set up to be able to do the injection. After that, we hook everything back up into their main irrigation system, and they do the irrigation. So it's only a one-time visit for the pumping piece. This is a picture of some of the early stuff, how deep it can go in our deep sands. You can really create, as you can imagine, some serious trouble here in our environmentally sensitive region. The lessons that we've learned, I think, from the blue dye work is that the early season for us is the most vulnerable time. The transplants are small, they don't need a lot of water, and it's very easy to over-irrigate during that period of time. And then in that early phase, we begin to increase the irrigation until we get to the mid-season, and then there's a period of about May 1st for us. Those of us that work with watermelon growers in particular know the growers better be paying attention around May 1st, because the irrigation demand goes up really steeply in a real short period of time. In the late part of the irrigation, when everything is full vine cover and we've got a lot of fruit on the plants and everything is really rocking and rolling, it's really hard to over-irrigate at that point in time. Much more difficult. So our real impact has been made in the early part of the season. And any single irrigation event, as long as they're starting out with good moisture in the soil, should not be any longer than about an hour and a half for a medium flow drip tape. And then our Eric Simone coined this phrase, the blue dye don't lie. And that's sort of the summary of the whole thing. We were able to put up on a virtual field day site, the bottom line here is a couple of videos to sort of show this. The Water Management District in our region was really interested in capturing some of this more permanently so that they could have a web presence, and we wanted to have a web presence of it as well. And that website is at that location, and I think Dr. Zottarelli has also some other sensor kinds of things that a bunch of us have been working on. So there's a whole series of short video modules at that site. If you get back home and don't remember the site, if you just search for Virtual Field Day Florida, something like that, it'll be the one that'll come up. I want to just share with you a couple of specific on-farm cooperator examples. Hopefully you've gotten the picture by now that we didn't do this on the telephone or on the internet or answering webmail. We did this with shovels and pumps and blue dye. And we spent a lot of time out with these farmers to be able to make this kind of an impact. And I want to share with you a couple of examples. In the lower right-hand side here, this is Mace Bauer, one of the county agents in that region. He served as a while as a BMP implementation team leader before he became the extension agent. And the farmer here, Donnell Gwynn, one of the very environmentally conscious farmers in that region and certainly one of the leaders among that region. We're going to talk here primarily about his watermelon farm. And Mace working with some multi-level sensors that I suspect we'll probably hear a little bit more about next. But this was using the technology with a data logger and soil moisture sensors at 4, 12, and 20 inches and being able to show the farmer this is a different way of getting at the blue dye deal. In other words, at the top, on the top graph there, don't worry too much about what the soil moisture actual numbers are, but just the principle here at the top shallow area, the four inch level, you get a lot of variation in moisture levels throughout the day or after an irrigation event or after a rainfall event. When you get down to 12 inches, hopefully that's going to level out a little bit more and you're not having serious fluctuations of water moving through that profile. And in this case, almost you're going to get an A-plus on this particular management scheme where there's very little variation down at 20 inches. You don't see peaks except maybe over on the right-hand side after one of those rain events on June 12th or 13th. So the farmer now has done a really good job and has not moved, thank you, Gordon, has not moved the water down any deeper than it needs to be. So that was a little bit more of an automated deal, and our farmers are definitely becoming more technology savvy. So I think we're moving more into this kind of a category. But those other operators that still may be more comfortable with a portable TDR sensor are going to be able to get the same kind of information that we would have just seen there in that example. So that was sort of an irrigation focus, refining the drip system by using those sensors. In this case, this is Putnell Farms. This is the younger guy who began to adopt a lot of this petiole sap testing kind of stuff, and it was definitely would be my prized pupil of the grower cooperators in this. Putnell Farms, it's also a diversified farm in that region and a pretty big watermelon grower, one of the key lead watermelon growers in that particular area. For their fertigation, early on, they put a little bit of fertilizer under the bed following something very similar to the IFAS recommendations in terms of nitrogen and potassium in the bed. And so the first couple of weeks, we do not need to inject any nitrogen or potassium based on the fact that they've got some under the bed. And then at some point, we're going to start injecting nitrogen and potassium as we work our way through and using the petiole sap testing meters to kind of refine that. And this is Riley Putnell here. He has his own set of meters. I mentioned earlier, all of our agents now have these meters to help guide it. We're not looking for specific research numbers out of these meters. We're just looking for these meters to help guide us. And this is an actual data set from Riley back a couple of years ago, where the blue and the green lines are the upper and the lower limits of where we want the nitrogen to be maintained, and the red line is what the grower was actually able to implement with the utilization of those petiole sap testing meters. So they've been a very valuable device as well in the process. This is what they used to look like. They're now a different looking device, although it has the same sensor. The Lacqua meters are the ones that you would actually buy now. You can only buy replacement parts for these old original Cardi meters. But nitrogen is definitely the one that fluctuates a lot more. Oftentimes we get very consistent results from potassium through the season, and this has been one of those things that our growers expect us to be able to help them with. And if they've got a dozen fields, we say, hey, if you collect the samples, we'll meet you under the shade tree at 2 o'clock and we'll take care of this. So they know how to collect them, they know how to preserve them, make sure that the samples are good when we get there, because there's just no way we can keep up with that many fields. So the overall summary here is that I think we've been able to have the connection of a lot of different demonstrations to be able to put the whole piece of the puzzle together over a series of several years. And we've also utilized different methodologies, the original research trials, drip irrigation schools, on-farm locations, and this is also working for large and small farms. In fact, our drip school is offered under our Small Farms Academy. And typically now, most of the growers that are large farms have already been through this piece of the puzzle. So now the folks that are coming are mostly in that small farm category. And it's easy to say that irrigation management is much more important than the nutrient management piece. It's not about whether the rate should be 150 or 120 or 175. It's about how good a job can you do as an irrigation manager. And if the rate is 150 and you feel like you need 227, then guess what? You're probably not a very good irrigation manager. Just a little side joke. The early BMP sign up with a lot of these plastic culture growers was this whole thing was really helpful to get them to understand why it was important for them to sign up. So they really were sort of the early sign up group in this BMP program.